To headlines, China warns of the spillover effects of the sanctions imposed on Russia over its offensive in Ukraine. Russia halts peace treaty talks with Japan, citing unfriendly positions taken by Tokyo over Ukraine. And no end in sight to the Saudi blockade of Yemen, as Riyadh seizes yet another emergency fuel ship bound for the war-torn country. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. China and Pakistan are expressing concern about the spillover effects of sanctions imposed on Russia over Ukraine. According to a statement released by the Chinese Foreign Ministry, Beijing and Islamabad have called for a ceasefire and diplomatic solution to the ongoing war in Ukraine. The two countries' top diplomats met in Pakistan's capital on Monday. Russia has been facing all-out sanctions from the West following its military operation in Ukraine. The sanctions are now affecting Moscow's economic relations with other states. The European Union, which has been at the forefront of the sanctions campaign against Russia, is also divided on whether to impose further restrictions due to the negative impact that it has on the bloc's economy. U.S. President Joe Biden once again accusing Russia of considering the use of chemical weapons in Ukraine. Biden says President Vladimir Putin's back is against the wall. According to the U.S. president, Russia is now setting up false flags, preparation for using chemical weapons. Biden says these include Moscow's allegation that Kyiv has biological and chemical weapons, but has not offered any proof to back his claims. Moscow says it has evidence of Washington helping Ukraine make chemical weapons in biowarfare labs near the Russian border, but the U.S. denies that. Political analyst Barry Grossman believes it is the U.S. that could be planning a false flag chemical attack in Ukraine to blame Russia.
The main difference between what is unfolding now in the Ukraine and what took place in Syria being that the speechwriters for Biden are a little bit more clever in that they're saying in advance that they're anticipating a false flag, which in fact the Russian, it's a sort of double false flag scenario, all of which is nonsense, as is the notion that the Russians have their back against the wall. They've been executing a very limited military operation with very key objectives in mind. It's not like all of the Ukraine is caught up in some kind of a conflagration of war. The Russians can turn up the heat. They don't need to resort to things like chemical weapons. There's no evidence that Russia has any intention to use chemical weapons, and there's no need, and it certainly wouldn't help Russia's position in the slightest. If there is anything to be concerned about, it's the possibility that this claim foreshadows an intention on the part of the Americans and the usual suspects now, including the Ukraine, to stage a false flag using chemical weapons and blame Russia.
Russia says it has broken off peace treaty talks with Japan because of Tokyo's unfriendly position against Moscow over Ukraine. Russia says that it does not intend to continue the negotiations under the current conditions. The move has drawn a reaction from Japan, with Prime Minister Fumio Kishida calling it completely unacceptable. Japan has recently imposed a series of sanctions on Russian financial institutions and exports. The two countries have not signed a peace treaty since World War II, due to a territorial standoff over a set of islands. Russia also says that it has withdrawn from talks over joint business projects on the islands and has ended visa-free travel to the territory for Japanese citizens. Russia has signaled dissatisfaction with ongoing negotiations to end the conflict with Ukraine, calling for more active and substantive talks. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says that Moscow does not intend to publicize its detailed demands from Ukraine. Russian and Ukrainian officials have held several rounds of talks since Russia began a military operation in Ukraine nearly a month ago. The most high level of the negotiations were held between the foreign ministers and Turkey, but diplomacy has so far failed to produce any breakthroughs. The Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has repeatedly called for direct talks with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, saying that he is ready for a compromise to end the conflict. Moscow says the latest round of talks has not made enough progress for a meeting between the two leaders. The EU takes a major step forward in establishing its own army against the backdrop of the conflict in Ukraine. EU foreign and defense ministers have adopted the so-called strategic compass, which will involve a huge increase in military spending. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
At present, the 27 nations in the European Union spend 1.5% of their economic output on weapons and troops. That is about to increase significantly because EU ministers meeting in Brussels have just adopted their strategic compass following 2 years of negotiations.
Today, the military expenditure in Europe of all member states adding up, it's about 200,000 million euros. We have to spend more.
In his press conference, Borrell highlighted that combined EU nations already spend four times more than Russia on military capabilities. But that is still not enough, he said. He insists the bloc's military plan will not undermine NATO. Many analysts say there's no doubt that it will. But that's not a bad thing, as NATO is driven by an aggressive US foreign policy, they suggest. Foreign and defence ministers are in the process of creating an EU army. They say the conflict in Ukraine proves the importance of such a move. When opinion polls are carried out, most citizens always agree they don't want more money being spent on war machines.
The more we put and focus energy on something wrong like war, you know, it increases the chance that war is coming to us.
I just think it's to make the people feel safe, but I don't really think it will change anything, so I think they should spend money on something different.
There is also resistance to the huge amounts of money being spent by the 30 countries that make up the NATO military alliance.
My party and my political friends, we want that Germany goes out of NATO. We want to bring Russia into Europe because Russia is a part of Europe and the United States are far from Europe.
NATO and EU leaders will hold summits later this week here in the Belgian capital. Peace activists are calling for greater diplomatic efforts by them to end the bloodshed in Ukraine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saudi Arabia impounds yet another emergency fuel ship bound for Yemen amid a deteriorating humanitarian crisis there. The Yemen Petroleum Company says the ship, en route to the port city of Hodeidah, was seized on Monday. The vessel was detained despite being searched and holding entry permits from the UN. Two other ships were seized earlier the same day. The Saudi-led coalition has held dozens of ships over the past 1.5 years, blocking Yemen's much-needed fuel imports. The humanitarian situation is deteriorating in Yemen due to an all-out Saudi blockade. Much of Yemen's vital sectors, including hospitals, as well as electricity and water services, have already come to a halt. According to the UN, more than 23 million people now need assistance. That accounts for about 3 out of every 4 people. Among them are 19 million who will go hungry in the coming months. Our correspondent Sana Abdullatif al-Washali tells us more about the latest fuel seizure by Saudi Arabia.
All the ships detained by Saudi Arabia have permits by the UN. They were inspected by a special committee belonging to the United Nations, and they are supposed to enter the country without any problems. But unfortunately, people here believe that the UN supports these acts and it keeps covering and providing the political cover-up for the Saudi violations against the Yemeni fuel ships. Unfortunately, what comes now to Sana'a and the liberated areas in the north of Yemen comes from Aden Airport. The fuel prices have been raised a lot, and today the price of a liter of petrol or gasoline has reached $5, and this is really high compared to all the countries around the world, and this will keep only worsening the humanitarian situation. And absolutely, this fuel crisis has affected all the vital sectors of the country, all the public services sectors. Today, the health ministry announced that several health facilities has to stop providing services as they didn't have any fuel to generate power and operate the equipment. Unfortunately, this threatens the lives of millions of people here in the country, including women and children, who are the most affected segments in this community.
The UK's cost of living crisis is escalating almost by the day, with more and more Britons facing the biggest fall in living standards since the 1970s. The highest inflation rates in 3 decades are forcing millions to the brink. Charities are asking the government to do more to help poorer households.
To many, poverty in England is a figment of the imagination. But with the living costs climbing up every day, just getting by is becoming more of a struggle than ever. And not just for the vulnerable.
When we go out just to do shopping for the kids, if I see like 5 years, 10 years back, £100 worth it to spend, you can buy a lot of things. But if I go today with £100 and to buy a grocery for my home or kids, I mean, I cannot even fill the basket.
Announcing a phase-out of Russian oil imports earlier this month, Prime Minister Boris Johnson spoke of dark days ahead, but those days seem to be here already. Charities such as Step Change are calling on the government to increase welfare benefits and offer more help with skyrocketing energy bills. There are families who can only turn on their heating for 2 hours a day and use torches at night rather than spending on electric light. The answer from the government has left a lot to be desired. Chancellor Rishi Sunak says he cannot fully protect people from the consequences of rising prices.
There are lots of different ways he could try and play this. What he shouldn't be doing is just tinkering with, say, a little bit off the petrol or a little bit off the gas price. That won't make much difference. Focus on the weakest in society, paid for by those who are the strongest in society. Those with the broadest shoulders bear the greatest weight.
To try to curb the soaring cost of living, the Bank of England has upped interest rates, but it's a fine balance.
Landlords will soon pass on the increases. Rising interest rates affects everybody, including renters. But not everybody is affected equally. Because when you're spending every last cent on housing, food and fuel, what's there to cut when the prices keep going up?
It means more people pushed into poverty. 2.5 million people in the United Kingdom used a food bank in the past year. A former prime minister has called the crisis the worst he has ever seen.
You're going to see, I'm afraid, a significant rise in the cost of living for Britons over the next 2 years. It's not just the current level of basic items, such as the cost of fuel, the general sort of power for utilities and things like that, but also the basic cost of food. Now, that's today. The bit I worry about is actually what's going to happen in 6 months, a year's time.
It's a time of ordinary people trying to deal with extraordinary price hikes, with very little in the way of respite on the horizon. Saeed Pourreza, London.
In France, anti-government protests are becoming a regular occurrence less than 3 weeks before the presidential election begins. French households are being slammed by inflation, spelling difficulties for incumbent politicians. Ramin Mazari has more from Paris.
Since late last week, France has seen nationwide anti-government protests almost every day. March 17th's protests were over better pay and working conditions. March 19th saw the yellow vests and protests against state-sponsored Islamophobia and racism, while March 21st saw the record price of gasoline cause taxi drivers, truckers, fishermen, and others to protest nationwide. President Emmanuel Macron has joined the European Union's unprecedented sanction drive against top energy supplier Russia for its military operation in Ukraine, regardless of the economic costs on the average French household. The price of petrol has crossed the psychological barrier of €2 per liter, creating inflation in goods across the board. Those on low and fixed incomes are now being told to make sacrifices by politicians who may be living far more comfortable lifestyles.
Moi, je pense qu'ils souffrent vraiment.
I think that people are really suffering. Unfortunately, this doesn't mean much to our leaders. There are elderly people who live off canned sardines, if not canned cat food. French politics is 30 years behind where it should be. And if it doesn't change, there might be a civil war here.
Adding to the hardships being asked of the average French voter, Macron recently announced that if reelected, he will raise the retirement age to 65. That has caused the left-wing candidate, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, to jump in the first-round polls to third place, but he still trails the far-right's Marine Le Pen by several points.
They aren't even talking about inflation in the election campaign. For everyone in France, it's big news, but not to our candidates. Everyone who isn't rich is wondering if the energy price increases are ever going to stop, while the poor wonder if they are ever going to be targeted by government aid.
While inflation has soared, it's not like this is a new problem for the average French person. Despite long-time official claims of low inflation, reduced purchasing power has been the number one issue for voters in 2017 and 2012 as well. There will be at least two more days of nationwide protests this week. France's first round presidential vote is now less than 3 weeks away. Many are saying that the final days of Macron's five-year term are ending in a typical fashion, full of anti-government protests. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
It's been almost a year since negotiations to revive the 2015 Iran deal started in Vienna. Now the U.S. says that it's ready to make difficult decisions to return Iran's nuclear program to limits that have been set out on the landmark accord. State Department spokesman Ned Price says one of the remaining issues for the U.S. is Iran committing to verifiable limits on its nuclear activities, return for an easing of sanctions. Price said the agreement is neither imminent nor close, and that Washington is preparing equally for scenarios with or without a mutual return to the deal. Tehran is demanding the removal of U.S. sanctions in a verifiable manner, as well as guarantees that any possible agreement will ensure sustained economic benefits for the country. A senior Iranian cleric, Ayatollah Mohammad Mohammadi Reshadi, has passed away at the age of 76. Ayatollah Reshadi had been hospitalized in Tehran in recent days due to an illness. He was the first Iranian intelligence minister after the 1979 Islamic Revolution. He also served as the prosecutor general, as well as a member of the Assembly of Experts for two terms. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has in a message offered his condolences on the passing of the cleric. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the televised speech delivered on March 1st, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Mab'ath. The Holy Prophet began his astonishing migration to Medina, followed by other Muslims. Little by little, the immigrants arrived in that city. Before the migration, the Holy Prophet sent an emissary to Yathrib, Medina. He sent Mus'ab ibn Umair as his representative so that he would recite Quranic verses for the people. So he laid the groundwork. Later, the Prophet himself migrated to Yathrib and established the Islamic government. That was the pinnacle of the Holy Prophet's movement. And he was not satisfied with the mere formation of a government and the mere rule over the people. He also began to confront the enemies in a comprehensive manner because the enemies would not leave Muslims alone. He formed an army, prepared warfare, and attacked the enemies. In certain places, he engaged in defense, and in certain other places, he engaged in attack. He did both. Some people claim that the Holy Prophet's wars had only a defensive nature. But this was not the case. Some had a defensive and some had an offensive nature, according to the circumstances. Subsequently, he encountered the base of polytheism, which was Mecca. He conquered that city and God's house became accessible to Islam and Muslims. So he gave stability to the Islamic government. This is the most stimulating part of the Islamic movement. How do the promoters of this viewpoint want to separate Islam and religion from government?
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The next point about Ba'atha is that one of the most important slogans and positions of the Holy Prophet was confronting jahiliyyah, ignorance. In the Holy Quran, ignorance has been censured many times. Jahiliyyah, or ignorance, whose meaning I will explain later, has been disparaged many times in the Holy Quran. In Surah Al-Ma'idah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "Do they then seek after a judgment of the days of ignorance?" Chapter 5, verse 15. And in Surah Al-Ahzab, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "And make not a dazzling display like that of the former times of ignorance." Chapter 33, verse 33. In Surah Al-Fath, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "While the unbelievers got up in their hearts the heat and verbiage of ignorance." Chapter 48, verse 26. This has been mentioned in other Quranic ayahs, verses as well. But I remember these three ayahs, which I have written down.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has visited the United Arab Emirates in his first such visit to an Arab state since the beginning of foreign-backed violence in Syria in 2011. Meeting with Assad on Friday, Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan stressed that Syria is a fundamental pillar of Arab security. The Emirati official added that his country is keen to strengthen cooperation with Syria, describing the two nations as brotherly peoples. Assad, for his part, urged that in order to protect the regional countries must continue with adherence to their principles, the sovereignty of their countries, and the interests of their peoples. Assad's visit to the UAE took place only months after the Emirates' foreign minister, Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan, traveled to the Syrian capital, Damascus. It also came amid the widely reported prospect of Damascus' return to the Arab League regional bloc.
So they are, along with the Saudi Arabia, they are rethinking their alliances with the United States, especially, and putting all of their eggs in the United States basket. They are thinking of, let's say, diversifying their alliances along other lines and looking towards China and Russia and other nations.
The recent thaw in relations comes despite the fact that almost all of the region's Arab states turned their backs on Syria in 2014 when Damascus came to face a huge wave of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism. Some of the Arab regimes even began lending financial and logistical support to the anti-Syria elements. Observers say the meeting serves to underline the regional Arab states' interest in resuming their normal relations with Syria, that together with its allies has done much in the way of emerging from the ruins of more than a decade of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism. It's worth noting that the United Arab Emirates used to be among the Arab regimes that backed foreign-sponsored militants operating to topple the Assad government. Experts, however, attribute such signs of rapprochement between Syria and its fellow Arab nations in the region to the Syrian government's ability to recapture vast swaths of its territory and turn the tide against the foreign-sponsored militants and terrorists. The Emirati foreign minister said during his visit to Damascus in November that his country supports efforts to reestablish stability in Syria, adding that what happened in the Syrian nation affected all other Arab countries too. He went so far as to say that Syria, under the leadership of President al-Assad and the efforts of its people, is able to overcome the challenges imposed by the war, noting that his country is always ready to offer assistance to the Syrian people. Yet, the U.S. opposition to warmer relations between its Arab allies and Syria on the one hand, and the UAE's move to normalize ties with Israel on the other, are raising questions about whether a rapprochement is possible between Damascus and Abu Dhabi.
They have seen that that the United States has and its allies have seized, for example, almost $2 billion in Venezuelan gold and then $9 billion in Afghan dollars held in Western banks. And now we're talking about several hundreds billions of Russian current money in Western banks, which is also being withheld from Russia. They're basically stealing it. So the UAE and Saudi Arabia are both rethinking whether they want to put all of their oil money into dollars which are held in Western banks, or whether they need to create new alliances.
The visit by top Syrian Emirati officials are a clear sign that 11 years of foreign-backed militancy in Syria have failed to achieve the desired result, and that those behind the conflict are beginning to realize that. In recent weeks, the United States has deployed several thousand American troops to Eastern Europe for what it calls helping the security in the region. But how can that help the security when it was part of the main problem why Russia attacked Ukraine in the first place? Moscow has become increasingly wary of NATO's expansion toward its borders and describes it as its red line. One can conclude that more American troops in the region can't help achieving peace there at all. Several U.S. and NATO officials have also noted that they are not looking for a direct conflict with Russia, rejecting Ukraine's calls for establishing a no-fly zone over the country and an offer from Poland to give its entire fleet of warplanes to Kiev. So, if there won't be a war with Russia, what objectives are the U.S. and NATO troops in East Europe accomplishing?
Well, for as secretive as the Pentagon is being with this new wave of deployments, the true goal behind them is fairly obvious. Russia has defied NATO hegemony in Ukraine and has proven that they are capable of both militarily and politically rejecting and defending themselves against NATO aggression. So what the Pentagon wants to do with this new wave of deployments is essentially twofold. They want to simultaneously assert NATO's dominance in the near Russia regions, like the Baltic states and the rest of Eastern Europe and Central Asia. And they also want to prepare, or at least posture for the preparing of, further military aid to support, either directly or through further NATO deployments.
Even if the troops are there to conduct military drills, which will, by the way, draw the ire of Russia, there should have been a lot more footage and photos of the troops there, as is usually the norm. But data about what the U.S. troops are doing there has been curiously scarce. The number of American soldiers in Europe has increased by several thousands in the last several weeks. That's according to NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. Speaking alongside the German Minister of Foreign Affairs, the NATO chief said the 30-member military alliance has increased its deterrence and defense, especially in the East, with hundreds of thousands of troops on, quote, heightened alert there. According to Stoltenberg, 60,000 troops are under direct NATO command.
But we face a new reality for our security. So we must reset our collective defense and deterrence for the longer term. Today, we tasked our military commanders to develop options across all domains: land, air, sea, cyber, and space. On land, our new posture should include substantially more forces in the eastern part of the alliance at higher readiness, with more pre-positioned equipment and supplies.
U.S. President Joe Biden's policy on NATO is a departure from that of the former Trump administration. Back in 2020, Donald Trump planned to withdraw 12,000 U.S. troops from Germany over a spiraling feud with the NATO ally that he accused of taking advantage of the United States on trade. The former president was also critical of European nations for failing to meet NATO's defense budget. But Biden stopped the measure before it even started. The conflict in Ukraine has given the U.S. another excuse to expand its military presence in Europe. Increasing the number of troops overseas means more military costs, which in the event of a war with Russia would be even higher. Can the U.S. and its NATO allies afford the costs and the risks?
Prior to the special military operation in Ukraine, much of the Western media and the Pentagon itself had essentially doubted Russia's military capabilities of defying NATO hegemony, and they were looking to expand NATO influence into Eastern Europe and Central Asia. So they did not view Russia as a threat prior to the special military operation and the essential evisceration of the Ukrainian military during the process of it. So Russia has proven that they can and will oppose NATO hegemony and will defend themselves against NATO aggression.
So far, the West's response to the conflict in Ukraine has been imposing a slew of sanctions on Russia. Whether that can get them what they want, or it turns out to be shooting themselves in the foot amid a deepening energy crisis, is anybody's guess at this point.
The fate of many months of intense negotiations in the Austrian capital, Vienna, to revive the 2015 Iran deal hangs in the balance. The dialogue seems to face a make-or-break moment in the coming days. A draft text of an agreement between Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, is almost complete. The diplomatic effort seems to be near a climax, but still the very few remaining gaps in the text are keeping the whole thing in limbo. This week, Iran's top diplomat Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the parties are closer than ever to a final agreement.
The Iranian government has made it very clear that the red lines that have to be respected and not crossed include a respect for Iran's missile program, which is well within its sovereign rights, a lifting of the brutal economic sanctions that have been placed on the Iranian nation and the Iranian people, and likewise for the guarantee that the United States would not remove itself and break the deal once again.
Hossein Amir Abdullahian said that Tehran is ready for a final deal if its red lines are observed. He said a good and lasting deal can definitely emerge in Vienna if the United States acts realistically and refrains from making new and wrong demands. He made the remarks soon after a trip to Moscow, where he sat down with his counterpart Sergei Lavrov. The meeting came amid speculations that Russia's demands for written guarantees from the U.S. to ensure that Tehran-Moscow trade ties will not be affected by Western sanctions over Ukraine have complicated the Vienna talks. But the Iranian and Russian top diplomats made it clear that that is not the case. During a joint press conference with his Iranian counterpart in Moscow, Lavrov ended speculations about Russian demands regarding the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The Russian foreign minister made it clear that Moscow has received written guarantees from Washington that Western sanctions will not prevent cooperation within the framework of the Iran deal. He noted that no illegal sanctions can stop the growth of Iran-Russia ties. The top Russian diplomat stressed that Moscow wants a quick revival of the JCPOA, and the Americans must return to the agreement and lift their illegal sanctions. The ball now seems to be in America's court if it is serious about reviving the JCPOA. Negotiators in Vienna have been trying to find a way to remove American unilateral sanctions against Iran and allow the U.S. to return to the 2015 deal. The U.S. sanctions were imposed after U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018. U.S. President Joe Biden has acknowledged that his predecessor's pullout was wrong. But Biden's words have done little to solve America's credibility problem.
So one of the things that we have to be very concerned about is that the U.S. Unwillingness to agree that they will never leave the deal and resume coercive sanctions means that it is very likely that if another U.S. administration is elected, especially a Republican one that is more hawkish on foreign policy and more closely aligned with Israel, that they will leave the deal and reimpose sanctions on Iran. And one must be made very well aware of the fact that the Zionist lobby in the United States is extremely powerful.
Observers believe that the United States, as the party that abandoned the deal and threw the JCPOA in tatters, is expected to do more now that the negotiations have reached this critical stage. The coming days will probably show whether Washington will take the necessary political decisions.
A major cyber attack has hit websites of different institutions in Israel. A number of websites, including the website of the Ministry of Interior and Ministry of Military Affairs, were affected. Israeli officials say the ministries of health, welfare were also targeted, as well as the Prime Minister's office. Sources have described the incident as the largest ever cyber attack carried out against Israel.
If what goes around comes around, and after all these years of attacking other people's systems, computer systems, now the Israelis are suffering their own attack.
Internet Access Advocacy Group NetBlocks said a significant disruption has been registered on multiple networks supplied by Israel's leading internet providers. There were reports of connectivity interruption across Israel. As of this hour, all the sites are back for activity.
Yeah, that's obvious. Everybody depends on computers now. The problem here is always going to be the problem with irregular warfare. How do you know who did it? Normally, what would happen in a moment like this is that Israel would immediately accuse Iran of doing it, no matter who did it. And then they would call for the United States to bomb Iran, invade Iran, overthrow the government, and so on and so forth. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And now you're seeing, I think, the limits of this cyber warfare, because it depends on political considerations.
Earlier this year, a hacker group called Moses' Staff struck Israeli closed-circuit television cameras in the occupied Palestinian territories and Rafael Advanced Defense System, which is an Israeli military technology company. The group released the images that were apparently taken from CCTV cameras belonging to Rafael Advanced Defense Systems on January 28th in 2021. The group said it had hacked into the closed-circuit television cameras on the streets of the occupied Palestinian territories. Back then, it posted a message regarding the cyber attack on its website, titled, "We See With Your Eyes." In November 2021, Moses' Staff announced that it had targeted a number of Israeli firms and acquired a vast trove of critical facilities maps, which included information on the location and characteristics of vital systems across the occupied territories. Moses' Staff added that the data included airborne mapping surveys with 5-centimeter accuracy and 3-dimensional images of Israeli military sites and important buildings. Moses' Staff further stated that the information it had was of immense significance. The group has hacked over 165 servers and 254 websites and compiled over 11 terabytes of data, including Israel Post, the Ministry of Military Affairs, files related to Gantz.
Yes, obviously, if the attack succeeded, they have stronger capabilities. That's obvious. But the bigger question is, who would it be? How are we going to deduce this from the evidence? The logical suspect would be Iran, because Iran has already suffered from numerous Israeli attacks. The Israelis even made a movie about it, a miniseries called Tehran, which is all about hacking the Iranian computer system.
The Electron Silag Company and Epsilor Company. Israel has been the source of tension in the Middle East region for decades. It has carried out numerous assassinations in different countries, including Iran. It's also responsible for actual physical attacks on Iran's nuclear sites. Iran has always stressed that Israel's crimes and attacks will not go unpunished, and the cyber field appears to be a new arena for this fight.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being. A brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام من اتجر بغير فقه فقد ارتطم في الربا.
أمير المؤمنين إمام علي عليه السلام stated, whoever trades without knowing the rules of religious law will be involved in usury.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Dear brothers and sisters, we find that the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is truly a universal persona, and this can be proven and seen and witnessed in the fact that even after the passage of well over 1,000 years, the words and the wisdom of Imam Ali is still applicable to the present day and age. We find that in certain places Imam Ali alayhi salam, he talks about certain qualities and characteristics, but he gives them a relationship as well. So for example, in one place, Imam Ali says that forbearance is a believer's supporter. In another place, he says that knowledge is a believer's friend. Well, there are three other qualities that Imam Ali has spoken about along with their relationship. His Eminence, the first divinely appointed Imam, says, "Tolerance is a believer's brother. Benefaction is a believer's father. And patience in hardships is a believer's commander." Tolerance and this kind of steadfastness, or this forbearance, for example, this tolerance that one individual has with another one, this kind of acceptance or leniency, is an individual's brother. And of course, we should be tolerant with each other amongst the Muslims and even amongst the non-Muslims. The next one was that benefaction is an individual's, a believer's father. And of course, this benefaction coming from beneficent, and that being one of the qualities of Allah, is also very important for a believer. But I wanted to focus on this last one, which is that patience in hardships is a believer's commander. Truly, this idea of patience, at least the patience that the Quran speaks about, is a patience which has determination, it has motivation, it has steadfastness, it has strength, it has courage. This patience is truly a commander during hardships. Because as a commander guides you through the difficult places and the difficult arenas of war, in this aspect, patience also guides you out of the difficult arenas of hardships. And so we must try our very best to remain patient during our hardships and our trials and our tribulations and our difficulties, so that by remaining patient, we will be able to be guided via this very patience, and of course, ultimately by the source of patience and guidance. Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, will guide us out of these different hardships that come about in our lives. A profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafiya. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, you must not allow uncertainties and doubt poison your mind. Skepticism or irrational likes and dislikes should not affect your views. But remember that before you start thinking and deliberating over a problem, seek guidance of the Lord and beseech Him to give you a lead in the right direction. Avoid confusion in your ideas, and do not let disbelief take hold of your mind, because the first will lead you to agnosticism and the others towards errors and sins. When you are thus prepared to solve any problem, and you are sure that you possess a clear mind, a sincere and firm desire to reach the truth, to say the correct thing, and to do the correct deed, then carefully go through the advice that I am leaving for you. If your mind is not clear, and it is not as free from doubts as you wish it to be, then you'll be wandering in the wilderness of uncertainties and errors like a camel suffering from night blindness. Under these circumstances, it is best for you to give up the quest, because with such limitations, none can ever reach the truth.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Before Wahhabism became powerful with this, petrodollars, Sunnis in general, their writers, their speakers, whenever they talk about Ali, they will say Karramallahu wajhu, or they will say Alayhi Salam. But after Wahhabism started to spread and have their influence in the Sunni world, the muftis go around saying that, you are being unfair to other Sahaba. You shouldn't say Karramallahu wajhu to Ali or alayhi salam. You should say to all of them radiyallahu anhu. And if you look at really, the Wahhabis call themselves Salafis. Salafis means those who follow the first generation of Islam. And all others, they are saying they are bid'ati. They invented things, added things into it. But if you go back into history, and I have prepared some, list of some of the, from the books that we have, we can do the search. When you look at the historians, people like Tabari, Ibn Sa'ad, Maqdisi, Ibn Qutayba, Ibn Athir, Bayhaqi, Ibn Khaldun, Baladhuri, Al-Dhahabi, and many others. And these are all those who lived in the first 10 centuries of the Islamic history. They used the name, the title, Karramallahu Wajhu, after the name of Ali. Even if you look at the books of Hadith,